Blog Talk Radio.
Broadcasting.
And welcome, everybody, to the Dragon's Lair on Renegade Broadcasting, the best source for factual information on the planet. And yes, it is very clear by those lyrics that Mr. Ronnie James Dio knew exactly what was going on. I should now have my voice back 100% or close to it. One could certainly tell in that last show the difference before and after music breaks. Sounded a lot better after I had a short rest. We'll see how it goes tonight. Hopefully I shouldn't have any trouble, and I've got a lot more reading for you. Tonight's show will be in multiple parts, as many as needed to get this finished and the information out there. And so tonight's show is called Paint It Black. It will be about Martin Luther King Jr. If you read the description, he was a plagiarist, a traitor, a communist, a criminal, a philanderer, a womanizer, and basically just an overall sleaze. A beast as a saint? Well, that's what we have a holiday for. So I intend to destroy this sacred cow. Additionally, I want to have a little commentary on architecture in response to James's show last Tuesday. And I want to do a little short piece on what is commonly called Norse mythology. Now, before we get started here, I want to be sure and give everybody a listen to all the other hosts here on Renegade. Until further notice, I believe it's Kyle on Mondays, to be determined, and or Wild Card Tuesdays with the guest host, or possibly a secondary show by one of the regular hosts. Will on Wednesdays, Mike on Thursdays, and Lou on Fridays. Roundtable on Saturdays, and me, of course, on Sundays. And by the way, I think all of our guest hosts have done a great job. I think they're truly a good reflection of the quality of our listeners. For the record, today is March 3rd, 2013, on our screwed-up Christian calendar. I want to clarify something. I misspoke last week. I said that the sun was at 14 degrees Pisces. It was actually at 5 degrees Pisces. Somehow I got that screwed up here in my notes. So anyhow, today the sun is at 12 degrees Pisces. Mercury is still retrograde and will be retrograde for the next couple of weeks or so. And again, so expect delays, communication, general confusion. Additionally, for me, as I've mentioned before, I'm still going through a solar arc. Mars conjuncting my natal ascendant will for a few weeks to come. This usually represents a new beginning. I see this radio show as part of that new beginning. I also want to mention that I'll be doing a show on astrology this Tuesday night, March 5th, as I have had a significant number of requests to do so. So be there or be talked about. Additionally, again, watch on YouTube, Quantum Astrology, before listening to my show, please. Everyone can gain something from it. And if you have not seen it already, if you have seen it already, watch it again anyway. It would be greatly appreciated. I will not monitor the chat. I may glance at it during music breaks. We'll see. Depends on whether or not I have any other issues to deal with. Again, I'll be drinking my water and smoking where I'm sitting. So that will cause momentary pauses at times, such as right now. I'm going to take a drink of water. And there will always be the occasional silence for a cough or some hacking. We have a chat room over at renegadebroadcasting.com. There's also a live feed of the show tonight, unless there's some technicalities. With the chat room itself, the webpage is renegadebroadcasting.chitango.com. And if you decide to join a social network that Kyle created called alternativesocial.com, there is a chat room over there. And I also want to mention a website, www.nationalprotectionism.com. This is a project that Mike has created, and we want to get everybody's support and get everybody behind this. And I also want to thank Mike for his kind comments about me on his shows last week, or one of his shows. I see what I'm doing as simply what I've been doing for the last 15 years, only I'm just doing it in a different format. And I want you to keep up your good work, and certainly we need more people like you. And I think your example will bring others to our cause, as well as to get them to step up and take on a role similar to what we are doing here at Renegade. Again, I have no personal website or blog as of yet. I say that loosely. I will probably not have a life if I did have one between doing these shows and work and other stuff that's going on. There will be no shows tonight, or no calls tonight. I have way too much material to cover. As I mentioned before, I'm going to do as many shows as necessary to get this information across. Hopefully we'll get it in two. If you'd like to contact me, you can send me an email at magus_18@geocities.com. That's magus_18@geocities.com. If you want to subscribe and be on my e-list, just send an email that says subscribe, or you can just write me. Can't guarantee I can get to all of my emails. My eyes have been bothering me a little bit the past couple of days. Hopefully that should not be a problem here tonight. One difference between now and the other shows is that the cat will not be joining me. She is not feeling well and is in the other room. Something I think she may have eaten has caused her some issues. And last night I was really thinking she was close to passing on. I think maybe it may be something in the food that she has eaten, but today she seems to be doing significantly better, but she is definitely not 100%. So I will not have her energies here next to me to help me out. I'd like to make another comment here on guns. If guns kill, then how do people get out of gun shows alive? Do spoons make you fat? Do pencils misspell words? Okay, I told someone in the chat a few days ago I'd like to send them some info on a particular topic that they requested from me. Well, I need till after next Wednesday to get that to you. I've just got too much going on here between this show and the show I'm doing on Tuesday, work, and then the cat issues have come up. So just hang on a little bit tighter. What I want to do here is I want to discuss some things about James's comments regarding architecture. And what I want to go ahead and do after that is a commentary on the esoteric Norse religion. I have seen some discussions coming up here recently about it, and there was also some people who weren't quite sure that my relationship that I was giving it to something else was appropriate. So I want to try to discuss that and clarify the point. In the meantime, I want to go ahead and play another song before I get started on that architectural discussion.
Oh,
Okay, I'm back. Yes, I was listening to the archives of James's show and thought he brought up an interesting point regarding building codes and architecture in general and how that affects our freedoms. And ultimately, I could probably sit here and talk for a good hour and a half, maybe 2 hours on that one subject, but I'm certainly not going to do that tonight. That will have to be brought up in another show in the near future, but I do not want to put that off too long because I consider that to be very important. You know, if you go outside your abode, whether it be a house, apartment, boathouse, hotel, wherever it is you're living, unless you're just off in the middle of the woods somewhere and nothing else is around you but trees, everything you see around you is done by somebody like me. And that has an effect on society and on multiple levels. And that affects how you feel, the way you function, a whole host of issues. He brought up the issue of limitation on freedom. Well, that's true. And that's sort of a mixed bag. Most people are used to hearing what the sovereign citizen movement has brought up in the past about, well, I own this property, I can do whatever I want, you know, and you can't tell me I can't do this, or you can't force me to have to do that, or whatever the case is. Well, that's true in the United States, but perhaps not elsewhere, and that's only been in the past. And I mean, it's modern society. It's totally changed things. And yes, it's part of the Roman civil codes if you want to look at it from that aspect. And it's a mix between common law and the Roman civil codes. But at the same time, cities are important. Communities are important. Neighborhoods are important. Some uniformity is necessary. We can't have a chaotic society. And from my perspective, if I was to do a custom house somewhere out in the county where there's no particular jurisdiction for that area, I would still design the project according to the minimum level of building codes simply to protect myself. If something happened and somebody sued me and I did not at least meet these minimum standards building construction, then I would be inviting myself a lawsuit. And, of course, that still doesn't mean anything. They could still sue me anyway. I knew somebody, So there was a lawsuit involved with one of the firms that I used to work for. Some guy got up on the top of his house with the ladder next to some electrical lines, wound up electrocuting himself, and fell off to the top of the house. It was a two-story house, and I don't know if he died from the electrocution or if he died from hitting the ground or both. But they sued everybody. They sued the structural engineer, the architect, the developer, the builder, the electric company, you name it. You know how this goes. So anyway, one day in the very near future, I will discuss this. And I will say this too. When France capitulated to Germany in World War II and Adolf Hitler took a tour of Paris, he brought with him two competing architects to tour the city with him, because architecture is ultimately that important to society. And we have also heard this expression that, well, you know, the oldest profession, we all know what that is inferred. But if you ask me, I think that architecture is probably the oldest profession. So anyway, another thing I want to discuss here tonight is a little bit about Norse mythology, or at least that is what it's called. Now, I have done some shows with Mike here in the past, and I really wanted to get to this while I was doing those shows, but there was just not enough time to do so. And so it kind of got shoved on the back burner. And what I'm going to tell you is this. I'm going to read a little small essay here that somebody wrote over at The Joy of Satan about this. And I think it makes a lot of sense. But in order to fully understand this, you're going to have to go back and you're going to have to listen to my past presentations, or you are just not going to get it. Now, most people are familiar with what is called the exoteric. What is the outer meaning? What is the meaning to the average person on the street who is not informed to have the hidden meanings? What most people read is also to what we are left with after having all of the information tampered with by Christianity. And so there is enough there to figure out what the esoteric meaning actually is, but you have to be informed to understand it. Let me take a drink of my water here real quick. For some reason, my suffering from dry mouth right at the moment. And it has nothing to do with a bong, okay? Okay, so anyway, let me get started on this before we get into the Martin Luther King issues. In Europe, the missing eye symbology that you see in Votan is equivalent to the third eye symbology in other cultures. Okay, now there were also Gaels who were mistaken as being for Celts, and this is widely misunderstood in pop culture in general. By the way, I will discuss pop culture and on my astrology show as well. And if you really have an interest in this, I also recommend that you go see, or rather, you go to YouTube and watch a video called The Viking Serpent, or better yet, order it from Reality Entertainment, who are the creators of it, and then you will grasp some of what I'm about to tell you here this evening. Now, the Celtic religion is really not understood by most neo-pagans, and it was part of a larger Aryan religion. Keep in mind, too, that a lot of what we call Celt is in fact Gaelic, and that the Celts, in a sense, are really a mythological construct. There was really only a Teutonic world. Now, I realize that the word came from other sources, and they were used to describe these peoples, and so it was not necessarily a word that was native to the peoples that were being described. So anyway, let me get started here. In Germany and Northwest Europe, this was settled out of Ireland and the other isles probably around 10,000 years ago. The Druids, or the Nadrids, as they were called, worshipped a godman named, who many titles was also called Vod or Votan, who was hung on a tree, experienced a mystical death, and then reborn into a full god. The Tara Hill over an island was found to have been at least one time ringed by 300-plus oak trees as part of its sacred enclosure. In this part, Odin is symbolic of the life force, and the tree represents the human soul. This is why the other title for Votan is Budha or Budhaya. In Ireland, as it relates to Mercury, and in Sanskrit, which is really the original language of the Aryans. Now, Mercury is also symbolic of the life force. The science of alchemy in the East was literally called Nagara, which really is sort of after the serpent energy. Think sun and serpent as Naga, or serpent, and Ra, the sun, and what that means spiritually. In many ancient parts of the world, it was a literal serpent hung on a tree or a Tau cross, T-A-U cross. The Druids cut a cross into a sacred tree they used to honor Votan with. This is the meaning behind the Irminsul pillar that stood at one of the most sacred Druidic sites on the European continent till it was destroyed in a Jew-backed Christian crusade into the region. The Christian crusaders were fought against by pagan armies for decades, in some cases, till all of the fighters were killed to a man in an almost endless war. But it stopped the spread of Christianity further into Europe for centuries. The church did not have any real power in Northwest Europe till around the late 13th century. history has been rewritten as an attempt to cover this up. In this act against the Irminsul that sparked the Viking period, which led to several major Christian capitals being razed to the ground in revenge for the destruction of the Irminsul, this site also contains the history and sacred knowledge of the Aryan race going back over 15,000 years. The Irminsul is the Mount Meru axis, the world column or spinal column that connects the earth to the heavens, the root chakra to the crown, and the ascended serpent. The same pillar and religion of the Aryans was the exact same religion of the Innu pillar in Egypt. For some reason, this is lost amongst neo-pagans who write chapters of meaningless nonsense on the subject. This is one reason the pagan Bons, or the Cathars, worship a goddess named Mary, because another title for Astaroth is Isis, or Meru, or Mary. Literally, Mary, or Meru, the Mount Meru axis of the spinal column. The sacred tree was also called Asherah after her for this reason. As symbolically, Astaroth represented the Sophia, or the light of the serpent, or the yin aspect of the soul in the ancient world. That rises up the spine to eliminate one to their rebirth or gnosis. This reveals much of the Ismarun. The Bons also worshipped Lucibel or Lucifer. They knew the Catholic Church was a Jewish corruption and blasphemy of the Aryan religion, and they wanted nothing to do with it. The mysteries of the Hellenics, as Albert Pike notes, and by the way, I am going to do part of a show on Albert Pike, and I'm going to straighten up this issue about him once and for all. So let me reread this. The mysteries of the Hellenics, as Albert Pike notes, were the same as the Druids and the Egyptians. Hu, another title for Vaud, was the god who led the Aryans of the north to their new homelands. Hu was worshipped as Dionysus, also called Huas or Hyas. One of the main meanings of Dionysus relates to the sacred mount at the top of the spinal column or world column. Dionysus is the sacred animals are the black goat, the snake, and the peacock. And he also carries a spear or a staff. Further east, Dionysus is worshipped as Siva, literally. Even the ancient Greeks mentioned this numerous times, as did the Vedic Aryans of the east. Siva's ganas are the Bacchantes, Bacchantes, and both have the sacred phallus, etc. Again, that has nothing to do with homosexuality. That'll be covered under Pike and Freemasonry. Another title for Woden was Isis, and we look again at Dionysus. Okay, I know I'm not going to get this one right. Ichthys, or the fish, was one of the names of Dionysus, and the divine phallus was also known in the shape of a fish. The phallus is the spinal column with the kundalini fully risen. A, or Ea, is also shown as a fish-cloaked god in the Middle East and lord of the water as well as lord of the earth for the same reason. This represents the life force. As D.M. Murdoch notes, the word Buddha is related to the Egyptian term for sky god or father figure, Ptah or Ptah, as well as Pitha, as in Pythagoras, Buddha plus Guru. Now, Churchwood also states, Buddha is their representative of Ptah of the Egyptians. As mentioned before, Buddhism is the Christianity of the East, but under the corrupted form, some of the original is still lying there. You just have to look hard for it, which gives us forensic evidence to view the original if one can dig deep enough. When I state Buddha, I am not talking about the fiction Gautama, but the original pagan god and title. In Sri Lanka, Buddha is still also called Vod or Vodun, just as Christ Christos was originally the original title of the pagan sun god, which origins is Karast or Christ, the title for the resurrected pagan god. Both spellings mean sun or luminous. Buddhaya is also for the same reason and holds the same meaning. So we're looking at Vodun on a larger level. As a note, Christianity is literally a Jewish corruption from the original Aryan religion, of which all Aryan religions held the same tradition at the core. We are looking at the Grail here, as well as Bacchanalian rites, which had a special cup called Agathodaimon, good serpent in English, of which consecrated wine was drunk from. And Buddha had a serpent chalice that drinking from gave enlightenment and immortality or eternal life to. The wine represented the blood of the serpent or the kundalini energies mentioned in some texts as mercury or ether. And the cup represents the world or human soul. It should be noted that the Agathodaimon, meaning good serpent, what the title demon connects to as is serpents. In some texts, our gods were called the blazing serpents in the sense of shining ones. The serpent and the sun are one and the same. So we are right back to the magnum opus. The Grail is the literal symbol of Lucifer. The warrior must die pierced by a blade, essentially the sword in battle, to go to Valhalla. It is an allegory for the chaos stage in the ascent of the Kundalini and its piercings aspect. In the ancient world, the sword, spear, and dagger were also symbols of the serpent power. The Valkyrie takes him over the rainbow bridge to Valhalla, and we are looking at the Shaki rising up the spine to the crown chakra. In the east were Bonpo, or Po, another name for Buddhaya, was its core tradition. It was called the Great Perfection and centered on creating the rainbow body. The Vedas hold the same images of the rainbow, and so did the Hellenistic schools. The pot of gold at the end of the rainbow comes from such schools. It's an allegory that lived on in folktales. Votan carries a spear, which is the spinal column, with the head or tip being the pineal gland. It is also stated it is a symbol of the piercing aspect of the Kundalini. Just as Murugan carries a spear, of which the head also is depicted as a peacock feather, and Shiva carries the trident, and Patah the staff. And the Americans where the Aryans went and passed down this culture, the same god, Votan, is literally still called the Morning Star. Votan also leads the wild hunt, as does Shiva in the east. So this is why Votan rules Valhalla. For the same reason in the east, he rules Shambhala. What is totally called, what today is called Odinism, was based on transformation and perfection of the soul to Godhead. God in Sanskrit is Deva, D-E-V-A, which is the power of the spiritual sun. The entire text on Odin, the sagas, and the sagas, are allegories for perfection of the soul. They have been altered by Christians, but enough of the original is within it to get the extent of the understanding. So to be an actual Odinism, as it really was, and not how neo-pagan wishes it, one would have to literally be a dedicated spiritual Satanist to fully understand this. Also, Votan was known as Spear Shaker. Invert the word and you get Shake Spear or Shakes Spear. Additionally, any and all so-called fairy tales that we hear in our European culture are really allegories for passing on esoteric information. Hail Satan. I'm going to play one more song and we're going to get into the topic of tonight. Hold on, where did it go? There it is. Okay. Okay, I'm back. I hope you all enjoyed that. That was Helloween, who did a cover of a song called Hocus Pocus that was originally done by a band called Focus. And Helloween, as to my understanding, is mostly made up of members of two bands that are no longer in existence. One of them is Celtic Frost. So anyway, they do an excellent version of that. I actually like that better than the original, although it's very close. And by the way, yodeling is unique to European culture. So, shifting gears and going into some deep, dark, and very veiled history of this country, we'll get to Martin Luther Scumbag. Many of you listening are too young to have experienced the events of this time period. I myself do not have recollections of this man, even though I am old enough to and should have. My parents clearly sheltered me from many of the traumatic events during that time, including the assassinations of JFK, RFK, the deaths at Altamont Speedway, the deaths of Jim Morrison, Janis Joplin, Jimi Hendrix, etc. It was probably a good thing. If they are listening from another dimension, I thank them for it. Now, Martin Luther King. Most of his FBI file is sealed until the year 2027. There are 16,659 pages, of which only 201 pages are available to the public for viewing, and they are mostly on his assassination. So what are they not telling us? Well, some people have put some of the pieces together, maybe not all, but some. Now, I also want to mention that according to an author named Dan Smoot, and that's spelled S-M-O-O-T, and he's an American patriot, and he wrote in one of his books that Martin Luther King's dad, I will not say senior since that's not either of their real name, was connected to the CFR, the Council on Foreign Relations. Not a member, but he did work with related organizations connected to it. Now, first I want to mention, too, that, you know, I harbor no ill will towards black people for any reason. They were brought here against their will by Jews, and what has happened to them is very unfortunate, but we can't change that. But at the same time, you know, if you're black and you're born here, you need to work with the system and not try to buck it in a bad way. But unfortunately, we have a man who was prodded by others to go perhaps too far. Now, I will say this, you know, I don't really have any black friends personally, but I do have one someone I guess I could consider him a friend. I don't hang out with him in any way, shape, or form. But I went to get my hair cut in 1987. Yeah, 1987. And the person there did a really good job. And so the next time I needed one, I went back. And that person that did my hair before no longer worked there. There was another woman there who said, "Let me do it. No, give me a chance. Come on." And she was black. And I'm thinking, sitting here thinking, okay, this is 1987. All right, I still have long hair. And I'm thinking, okay, right. Okay. Well, anyway, I let her cut my hair, took a chance. She did a good job. That was 1987. This is 2013. I still go to get my hair cut to that woman. And she, no other person has cut my hair since then. And I haven't had long hair in a long time. So, I mean, I could go to practically anybody, but I still go to her. And her and I guess, in a sense, are friends. In reality, that's probably one of the longest relationships I have in my life, other than relatives. So, anyway, I also wanted to mention the Civil Rights Act of 1964. This took away freedom of association. This means that essentially you cannot always choose who you want to associate with or be around. You can no longer discriminate. Before that time, we had a right to discriminate. So, for example, let's say you put a deed restriction on your property, and you said that this house or the property may not be sold to anyone but someone of the white race. And many people have that in their deed restrictions or even wills. And they're all on file in county courthouses and court records and county records all over the country. And it doesn't take long to start searching for a title search to start finding this sort of language. And that was very common. But now the courts have ruled that you can no longer discriminate, even if that was the will of the person. So this act of 1964 also preceded the 1965 Immigration Act. So what you're looking at here is a back-to-back whamming. You know, first they say, okay, you can no longer choose who you would like to associate with, and then, boom, we're going to just invite the whole planet into your country. And by the way, you can't discriminate against any of them either. Tough. So anyway, here we go. Let me go ahead and bring up this essay here. This is very long. I thought about trying to cull this thing, but the more and more I looked at it, it's like, man, there's just no way that I'm going to be able to convey everything properly. I'll miss something. I'll skip something and then read something else later, and then people will be confused. So anyway, I'm just going to go ahead and dive in and start reading, and we'll see how far I get, and I'm pretty sure I will not be able to finish it tonight. It'll probably wind up having to be wrapped up on the next show. Hopefully I'll be able to catch all of it then and won't have to go into another show. So anyway, let me cough and then we'll get going. Okay, general introduction here. It is generally believed that Martin Luther King Jr. was an intelligent African American who promoted harmony between the races. Numerous books, all of which talk about his deeds of valor to promote goodwill between both blacks and whites during a time when riots and strife regularly occurred in America, have been written about his life. He is generally regarded as a man of ethics, a man who fought against injustices. After all, he did receive the Nobel Peace Prize, and that in itself is something that is admired throughout the world. However, there is another side of King, one that no one dares to discuss. In today's politically correct society, it seems that much of King's life, the parts that do not convey his image of a leader who promoted peace, have been forgotten. Very few people, especially those who were not alive during that time King promoted his brotherhood, have heard about this other side of King. I challenge everything you have been taught about King's love of people and life and his nonviolent tactics and about his beliefs and ethics. I believe that this other side of King needs to be discussed. I feel quite strongly about this. In fact, judging from what I have uncovered about the parts of his life that have rarely been mentioned, I feel that a petition for redress of grievances is in order to have the Martin Luther King Jr. holiday repealed. In order to fully understand why I feel this way, just continue reading, which I will do. Okay, on January 15th, 1929, a boy by the name of Michael was born in Atlanta, Georgia. His father's name was also Mike. Many friends and relatives called the child Little Mike. Little Mike's family was somewhat wealthy, despite the poverty surrounding them during the Great Depression, and he lived in a 13-room house. His father was also called Daddy by Little Mike, and people in the community. He came from several generations of African-American Southern Baptist preachers. Daddy was married to a woman by the name of Alberta. She also attended Spelman College, a school in Atlanta for black women, and was the daughter of the first president of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People's Atlanta chapter. Little Mike had a sister named Christine and a brother named Alfred. Daddy was extremely religious and followed the Old Testament teachings word for word. He felt that such activities as dancing or playing cards were considered immoral. Oftentimes, he whipped his little son, Little Mike, for misbehaving. In 1934, after touring Bethlehem and Jerusalem at the expense of the Ebenezer Baptist Church's congregation, Daddy proclaimed he wanted to be called Martin Luther King and his son, Little Mike. would be renamed Martin Luther King Jr. Daddy did that because he admired the work of the Protestant reformer in Germany, Dr. Martin Luther, for whom the Lutheran Church is named after. Martin Luther King Jr. and Sr. both went by those names during the rest of their lives. Like most children, King Jr. played with other children. When he was young, a white child with whom King had been friends rejected him. King reacted to this and decided from thenceforth, he said, to, quote, hate every white person, unquote. Because of that, he did not socialize much with whites until college. Martin Luther King Jr. was academically advanced for his age. At the age of 15, he attended Morehouse College in Atlanta, Georgia. From there, he entered Crozier Seminary, I think I said that right, in Chester, Pennsylvania. While attending Crozier Seminary, he was introduced to and influenced by the late Dr. Mordecai Johnson, president of Harvard, who was a strong believer in Hindu leader Mahatma Gandhi. In 1955, when Martin Luther King Jr. was only 26 years old, he became pastor of the Dexter Avenue Baptist Church in Montgomery, Alabama. It was during that time he first gained public acclaim. There was an incident in which he participated that gained national attention. On December 1st, 1955, the event that led to King's claim to fame occurred when a bus driver ordered some African Americans to stand so that some whites could sit. Rosa Parks, an African-American lady, refused. She was arrested. King protested. He felt that the system, which allowed sitting privileges for whites on buses, was completely intolerable. In some places in the South during that time, African-Americans, although allowed to ride on the same bus as whites, had to use the seats in the back. King was head of the Montgomery Improvement Association boycott against the city's bus system. Because King was articulate, he had no apparent skeletons in his closet and was unafraid of the city's leaders, he was the natural spokesman against the busing system. Rosa Parks and the bus boycotts are discussed in more detail later on in this essay. On May 2nd, 1956, King's demands for integrated buses was met. He then articulated the rest of his plan. Two of our original proposals have been met, but we are awaiting on the third, employment of Negro bus drivers for predominantly Negro routes. While no one should be denied a place to sit, it seems unnecessary and extreme to force white bus drivers from their jobs of driving in predominantly Negro routes. Evidently, it seems that King felt that the implementation of preferential treatment for African-American applicants was a noble idea. One of King's aides mentioned, on King's behalf, the preferential treatment that they sought. On Sunday, July 21st, 1963, KTTV in Los Angeles, California, and other stations across the U.S. had a show called The American Experience. A few prominent African Americans were featured on the show: Wyatt Walker, an aide to Martin Luther King Jr., Malcolm X, who was also known as Little, was a minister of the Nation of Islam at the time, Alan Morrison, editor of the magazine called Ebony, and James Farmer, the head of the Congress of Racial Equality, or CORE, C-O-R-E. Malcolm X said that his Muslims wanted whites to give African Americans a nation, businesses, houses, etc., far away from white people. The others felt somewhat different. Walker, Farmer, and Morrison demanded full integration and compensatory preference, the exact term used, by coercive force if necessary. They felt that mere equality was insufficient. Massive preferential treatment, they said, was to be required. They felt that African Americans should be paid more for the same jobs that whites do, that employers should fire whites and replace them with African Americans, that employers should actively go out and find African Americans, provide transportation, and hire them, qualified or not, that the Constitution must be changed or replaced to enforce this, that America should rapidly move towards a socialist system, and that violent revolutionary measures would be taken if America failed to do this. Unfortunately, a number of politicians in Congress granted many of these demands, despite the protests of many honorable Americans. Whenever King's demands were not met, he used force and intimidation. In February of 1966, all the king's horses and all the king's men decided to launch an attack on a castle. Let me explain that. The castle, which they assumed trusteeship of, was a six-flat tenement in Chicago. This was done as part of his campaign to gain power among the poor, and he claimed to help them. King had no authority to do that. His power was only that which was derived from police state tactics. King felt that his morality was more important than the law and property rights. He deemed his actions to be supra-legal, or above the law. On several occasions, King preached that African Americans should disobey any unjust laws. At the time, there were some communities that did not allow African Americans to vote in full force by imposing certain restrictions on voters. Some communities required that you had to be able to read and write in order to vote, and many blacks living in rural areas were illiterate. King said that the people who resided in those communities did not have to obey the laws. Notwithstanding, communities where all blacks did have the right to change the law by voting, King went to the extreme of suggesting that blacks should not obey any laws that they disliked. On March 28, 1965, while King was on the television show Meet the Press, he stated his opinion of laws. Quote, "I do feel there are two types of laws. One is a just law, and one is an unjust law. I think we all have moral obligations to disobey unjust laws. I think that the distinction here is that when one breaks a law that his conscience tells him is unjust, he must do it openly, he must do it cheerfully, he must do it lovingly, and he must do it with a willingness to accept the penalty." Close quote. King is quoted as suggesting, "There may be a community where Negroes have the right to vote, but there are still unjust laws in that community. There may be unjust laws in a community where people in large numbers are voting, and I think wherever unjust laws exist, people on the basis of consciousness have a right to disobey the laws. However, King's suggestion to disobey unjust laws is something that could lead to anarchy. Who would decide what is just in an unjust law? Martin Luther King Jr. apparently decided that what laws should and should not be obeyed. According to Stokely Carmichael, a militant African American, he voiced an ideology very similar to King's comments, but much more blatant. He said, "To hell with the law." Certainly, Carmichael, much like King, felt his actions were super legal, as if he was obeying a higher law, his own. Now, when King's actions of disobeying unjust laws landed him in jail, he could always count on some good Samaritans to bail him out. The late Thurgood Marshall, an African American who became a member of the Supreme Court, was one of those good Samaritans. He was unhappy with the way King gave his bills to the NAACP when Marshall served as director counsel for the group. With Martin Luther King's group, all he did was to dump all his legal work on us, including the bills, said Marshall. And that was all right with him, so long as he didn't have to pay the bills. Because of problems between King and the NAACP's Chicago chapter, that chapter eventually formally split with King's group. Indeed, King did feel that he could decide what was legal and was not. He felt that rules did not really matter, that he only had to obey what he chose to obey. J. Edgar Hoover, the former director of the FBI, now deceased, described how King would just break laws to obey higher laws, King's laws. Quote, "Unfortunately, some civil rights leaders in the past have condoned what they describe as civil disobedience in civil rights demonstrations. Martin Luther King Jr., for example, after arriving in Chicago, Illinois, early in 1966 in connection with the civil rights drive there, commented about the use of so-called civil disobedience in civil rights demonstrations and said, "It may be necessary to engage such acts. Often an individual has to break a particular law in order to obey a higher law. Such a course of action is fraught with danger, for if anyone took it upon himself to break any law that he believed was morally unjust, it is readily apparent there would be complete chaos in this country." End quote. Let me take a quick drink of water here. Okay, due to the turmoil inspired by King and his friends in the 1966 Chicago riots, where he engaged in his civil rights war, Congressman Edward Derwinski of Illinois described Martin Luther King Jr. and King's cohorts as Dr. Martin Luther King and his professional riot-inciting group. The city of Chicago held a meeting hoping to avoid marches that were creating animosity and spreading the strength of the police dangerously thin. Residents noted that their attempts to appease the protesters were futile. One resident proclaimed, "Suddenly it dawned on us that the whole meeting was a farce. Every time we'd make a concession, they'd move to a new spokesman and push for something more. They never had any intention of calling off the marches. Trying to appease the unappeasable is an effort in futility, as the residents quickly learned, and the farce of the peaceful protest marches resumed." In the Chicago riot of July 1966, Mayor Richard Daley said the strife was planned. Dr. King's aides were in here for no other reason than to bring disorder to the streets of Chicago, noted Daley. Apparently he was right, since King had spoken to numerous gang members prior to the ordeal. King even went to the extent of showing gang members a film of the Watts riots that had occurred in Los Angeles. In the Baltimore Sun, or rather the Baltimore Sun, had an interview with King in which King's motives were clearly demonstrated. The Baltimore Sun revealed the following, quote, "In an interview, Dr. King acknowledged that his End Slumps campaign in Chicago is an implementation for the concept of black power, but under a more palatable name. Dr. King acknowledged that his Dr. King acknowledged that his presence in Chicago, the street rallies, sit-ins, marches, door-to-door campaign to sign up members of protesting units have more far-reaching aims than the immediate dramatization of problems of impoverished Negroes. Dr. King spoke at the headquarters of the West Side Organization, where a sign on the wall said, "Burn, baby, burn, boycott, baby, boycott." Roving bands of youths and some adults broke windows, looted stores, and stoned police cars and small police vans, end quote. The riot was intense. It began when African-American youths, numbering approximately 100, stoned a police car. Martin Luther King Jr. blamed the riot on Chicago Mayor Daley's refusal to make concessions to the civil rights program. "This is his typical style," said Congressman John Ashbrook of Ohio. "Rarely has Reverend King chastised looters, arsonists, and conspirators for violence. He always justifies their actions and directly or indirectly encourages them." When the weekend came, Illinois Governor Kerner was forced to use the National Guard because the police could not control rioting that in three nights included burning, looting, 2 deaths, 100 injuries, and extensive property damage, noted Congressman Ashbrook. I need to cough. Hold on. Okay, King had a discussion with the militant African-American Stokely Carmichael. In the discussion, King seemingly recommended to Carmichael that he should try to dislocate the functioning of a city, but without destroying it. These are King's words of advice to Carmichael. Quote, to dislocate the functioning of a city without destroying it can be longer lasting, more costly to the society. It is more difficult for the government to quell it by force. The disruption of cities you want will become much easier. End quote. Unfortunately for the U.S., King's followers not only disrupted the city, but almost destroyed a large section of Chicago following King's speech. Many respected African-American religious leaders felt that King was doing more harm than good and asked him to leave their cities. They said that they did not want their cities disrupted. They pleaded with King to stop his campaign, but it did no good. King continued to foment problems in the U.S. Reverend Henry Mitchell, the leader of a group of West Side African-American ministers in Chicago who represented about 50,000 African-Americans, felt that King should get the hell out of here. Mitchell and his fellow ministers felt that way because King's civil rights marching in 1966, he said, brought hate. If King wants to march on the West Side, said Mitchell, let him march with rakes, brooms, and grass seed. Mitchell continued, suggesting that African Americans in the Chicago area wanted peace, love, and harmony, not the violence that came to town with King. The late Bishop C. Fane Kyle, who was an African American, issued a news release that said King was directly or indirectly responsible for the chaos, anarchy, insurrection, and rebellion brought about through demonstrations and rioting throughout the United States in recent years, months, weeks, and days. Kyle said that King should be shorn of his power and imprisoned for his criminal acts and deeds for defying the courts of this land. Jesse H. Jackson, an African-American who was president of the National Baptist Convention at Kansas City, Missouri, said that King was causing problems all over America. Jackson said that King encouraged riots. Jackson said that King's actions were responsible for designing the tactics that led to a fatal riot in the death of Reverend A.O. Wright in Detroit. In May of 1961, King spoke at the Southern Baptist Seminary. After he gave his speech, three churches in Alabama voted to withhold funds from the seminary. King often warned of impending riots if his demands were not met. In November of 1967, he delivered a speech in Cleveland, Ohio. He warned of massive winter riots in Cleveland, Gary, which is in Indiana, or any other ghetto. King said a cadre of 200 hardcore disruptors will be trained in the tactics of massive nonviolence. The massive nonviolence mission of the cadre of 200 hardcore disruptors was ominous. Nationwide city paralyzing demonstrations. King even went to the extent of threatening two mayors, suggesting they would be the two outstanding men we have set up as lambs for the slaughter. King said that he was very pleased with certain victories of creative black power. The young boy who swore to hate every white person was now a man, and he was keeping the promise that he made in his youth. King's insurrectionist tactics were commonplace among the places that he attended. In one instance, King went to Albany, Georgia, and threatened to have a new drive for African-American rights. 10 days later, King set a day of penance following a night of rioting during which Negroes were arrested as they marched on City Hall, hooting, laughing, throwing bottles, bricks, and rocks at law officers, said former Congressman John Ashbrook of Ohio. The situation had been maintained, reported the police chief of police, until King returned to the city for an illegal demonstration. When the FBI expanded COINTELPRO, which is the counterintelligence program, in 1967 to include black nationalist hate groups, King's Southern Christian Leadership, which is SCLC, was targeted, Southern Christian Leadership Conference, I think, along with the Nation of Islam. King was probably under that listing because he would often associate with minorities who hated whites. For instance, he was allied with Cassius Clay, also known as the boxer Muhammad Ali. a professional African-American boxer who at the time was a member of the Nation of Islam. Later, however, it appeared that Clay changed his beliefs, unlike King. King also met with Malcolm X, and King had a meeting with Stokely Carmichael, offering him words of advice. You know, February 24th, 1966, Martin Luther King Jr. met with Elijah Muhammad, leader of the Neo-Muslims. During the National Conference for New Politics, which King listed as a member of its National Council, King delivered a speech. The people who attended were Vietnam War protesters, Black Power advocates, civil rights workers, representatives from a number of leftist organizations, and others. The Chicago Tribune of September 6, 1967, said the convention turned out to be an assembly of crackpots and innocent do-gooders who meekly did the bidding of a handful of Black Power fanatics. There were two marijuana parties that took place during the convention. Sex orgies took place before audiences of delegates. The words Black Power were written on the walls, hallways, and rooms of the hotel and were carved on the 15 elevators in the hotel where the delegates were staying. And much merchandise was destroyed. The peaceful people who came to hear King speak caused a total of $10,000 in damage to the hotel. And that was $1967, by the way. Okay, let me take a short break here, and we'll get right back. Let me pick a song. Okay, I'm back. Let's see here. All right. Although King spoke of nonviolence, his actions were designed to elicit violence. King once said, "Negroes will be mentally healthier if they do not suppress rage, but vent it constructively and its energy peacefully, but forcefully, to cripple the operations of an oppressive society." Notice how his apparent contradiction is utilized. He told African Americans they should not suppress rage, but vent it, so that it would cripple the operations of an oppressive society. Yet this forcefully crippling of society was to be done peacefully and constructively. What King was proposing was illogical and inconceivable. Lewis Waldman, a prominent black labor lawyer, described King's methods as follows. "The philosophy and purpose of Dr. King's program is to produce crisis-packed situations and tensions. Such a purpose is the very opposition of nonviolence, for the atmosphere of crisis policy leads to violence by provoking violence, and the provocation of violence is violence. To describe such provocation as nonviolent is to trifle with the plain meaning of the words. The U.S. government found that King's actions were causing violence, racial problems, and the destruction of property. The Louisiana Legislative Committee noted that King was leading the Negroes in the South down the road to bloodshed and violence." Although Martin Luther King Jr. often said, "I have a deep commitment to nonviolence," his escapades could hardly be considered nonviolent. He was merely using double talk. Congressman John Ashbrook of Ohio described the violence that occurred after one of King's nonviolent marches. On May 4, 1963, police dogs and firehouses were used to quell a demonstration by lawbreakers in Birmingham, Alabama. There had been violence, plain and simple. Martin Luther King Jr. and his right-hand man, Reverend Fred L. Shuttlesworth, threatened that the demonstrations would continue. There was, they said, no intention of relaxing pressure without such action. We negotiate from strength and will consider calling off the demonstrations after the action. This was the mood of the well-known nonviolence Dr. King. The day following actions by police dogs and firehouses, the New York Times reported that residents of Birmingham heard from the lips of King, the man who preached peace in the streets but led the lawless bands, "Today was D-Day, tomorrow will be double D-Day." One seldom hears Martin Luther King Jr.'s name without nonviolent slogans coming in successive breaths. But quite often the nonviolence of King leads to violence of riot proportions. The big lie technique is clearly used. Repeat nonviolence over and over so the public will believe it, and then practice violence or the encouraging of violence," end quote. A Birmingham judge also issued an injunction that forbade King from participating in the march there, which culminated in the aforementioned riot. King protested the injunction and took it to the Supreme Court. In June of 1967, the Supreme Court affirmed the conviction of King and seven others for violating the law. Justice Stewart, speaking for the court's decision, said, quote, "The rule of law that Alabama followed in this case reflects a belief that in the fair administration of justice, no man can be judged in his own case, however exalted his station, however righteous his motives, and irrespective of his race, color, politics, or religion. This court cannot hold that Martin Luther King Jr. and others were constitutionally free to ignore all of the procedures of the law and carry their battle to the streets. Respect for judicial process is a small price to pay for the civilizing hand of law, which alone can give abiding meaning to constitutional freedom," end quote. On the same day that members of the Supreme Court delivered their verdict against King's inflammatory escapades, riots were raging. In Tampa, Florida, Montgomery, Alabama, Los Angeles, California, and Cincinnati, Ohio, the riots were particularly intense. Giving the impression that he was righteous and the Supreme Court was wrong, King said that the Supreme Court's decision would encourage riots and violence, in the sense that it all but said that Negroes cannot redress their grievances through peaceful measures without facing the kind of decision we face. And how he figured that the measures he took were peaceful is something the world will never know. What is known is that the rioting to which he referred took the lives of a few people and ransacked the city of Birmingham. Of course, King's diatribe was stated 4 years after the Birmingham riots, which was brought to the attention of the Supreme Court. And he probably figured that everyone had a short-term memory and would not remember. Whenever police were sent to stop the random violence that King's followers caused, King would scream police brutality. It was a simple two-step process. King would provoke riots by his comments, and when the police came to stop the ensuing violence, his followers would resist and then blame any injuries on the police. King's methodology was very similar to what Fidel Castro used initially to take control of Cuba. Senator James Martin of Alabama stated in a distinct similarity between King's and Castro's methods, quote, "In a memorandum circulated in Cuba before the Communist Revolution, the first point in the formula was to discredit the police in every way by causing incidents which will lead to arrest, then charging the police brutality. The program now being carried out in the United States by Martin Luther King Jr. and others is following this formula to the letter. When King and those who constantly criticize the police know it or not, the shameful riots in Los Angeles in which screaming mobs burned, robbed, and murdered had not even ended before Martin Luther King was charging police brutality and demanding the firing of the nation's finest police chiefs," end quote. I need to cough. Okay, King claimed that there were problems in Montgomery, Alabama. He asked President Eisenhower to stop what King called a reign of terror. The city's police commissioner dismissed King's claim, suggesting that it was merely the rantings of a rabble-rouser agitator. The politicians were all too quick to cave in to King's demands. King influenced a large number of non-white voters. King even said, "We'll have Negroes so fired up that I believe they will withhold their support from candidates who do not respond to their demands." When King said fired up, he literally meant it. Oftentimes, houses, apartments, and other buildings were burned down after he delivered his inflammatory speeches. King's antics were designed to elicit violence from both his disciples and opponents. By staging marches in relatively peaceful communities, King would either, number one, cause his followers to engage in a riot, or, number two, provoke violence from his adversaries. Either situation worked well for him. If his followers caused a riot, the riot would gain international attention, and he would blame it on the racist whites, not his followers, and on unjust laws. If marches generated violence from his adversaries, King's followers would attain victimization status. Marchers would generate sympathy from peace-loving Americans, and it would force the government to enact more laws to prevent recurring violence and quell the nonviolent demonstrations. It appears that King figured his antics would make his battle seem honorable in the eyes of the masses, who would not take the time to delve too deeply into his methodology. The magazine Newsweek of March 22, 1965, described King's actions. "For weeks, Martin Luther King Jr. has been escalating his Selma voter registration campaign toward the state he calls creative tension, the setting for paroxysm, of segregationist violence that can shock the nation to action." There is no question that King's creative tension definitely shocked the nation, especially after the creative tension caused millions of dollars in damage from riots. The New York Times of February 24, 1964, had this to say about the method that was utilized. "The Negro's rationale in holding night marches is to provoke the racist element in white communities to show its worst. It appears that King was attempting to provoke anything but nonviolence." In the Saturday Review of April 3, 1965, King revealed his methodology. Number one, nonviolent demonstrations go into the streets to exercise their constitutional rights. Number two, racists resist by unleashing violence against them. Number three, Americans of conscience, in the name of decency, demand federal intervention in legislation. Number four, the administration, under mass pressure, initiates measures of immediate intervention in remedial legislation. And give me just a second to call. His scheme was brilliant, somewhat iniquitous, but nonetheless brilliant. First, he had his followers travel to relatively peaceful towns, places that were unaccustomed to seeing black power advocates, organized crowds, and the lawless element, and antagonize the townspeople with signs, marches, sit-ins, and chants. Next, the people residing in those peaceful communities who were unaccustomed to seeing demonstrations and who wanted to maintain a peaceful neighborhood rebelled against the marchers. It seemed that King desired the type of conflict to occur which he would blame entirely on racists, those whites who resisted his plans. King and his disciples would be viewed as the victims rather than the aggressors in the eyes of some Americans who were unaware of the full scope of King's activities and those of his colleagues. Finally, with this view that he portrayed as the victim going for him, he was able to have his demands met, the remedial legislation that brought about preferential treatment for blacks. In many cases, however, when King went to the big cities rather than the small towns, his followers rioted. When his followers caused riots, he would merely blame the unjust laws. After all, King claimed that his followers cannot be held responsible for their actions. Surely everything was the fault of those evil, bigoted whites, not the peaceful, loving, caring, oppressed non-whites who looted, burned, and destroyed the city. King's love for violence can be summarized by one of his remarks. A riot is the language of the unheard. King's attempt to excuse his cohorts and his own lawless behavior as being the righteous language of the unheard was evil. Evidently, this was one of those things he also loved. Okay. I'm going to stop and play one more song here, and I'm going to just give my voice another little break and see if I can go the distance after this one song, okay? I'll be right back.
Everywhere is freaks and hearing, sights and feelings.
Alrighty, I'm back. King professed that he loved the world and all those around him. He said it all the time and claimed to be a peaceful, nonviolent, loving citizen of goodwill. If he had such more love for everyone, his behavior should have validated those feelings. Well, it did not. On a couple of occasions prior to 1964, King even attempted to commit suicide. Although King may not have loved himself, he did care for some of his followers. King's love for people was oftentimes supra-legal, demonstrating what could only be defined as supra-legal love. Federal agents investigating King's life discovered that he violated some laws during the pursuit of his goals. Specifically, they discovered that King had violated the Mann Act. Now, that's an act by Congress regarding white slavery. On one occasion, King shared his love by being with a few different women in one night and then became involved in an argument with one of his ladies. The advocate of nonviolence became upset, hit her, and knocked her across the bed, said King's friend, the late Reverend Ralph David Abernathy. King's friends were also of questionable morality. For example, Bayard Rustin, who worked 5 years as an advisor to King, was once convicted of sodomy, sharing his perverted love with someone. The FBI had recorded much of the love, which was shared by many of King's disciples. The FBI had been keeping tabs on King by tapping King's phone and bugging his quarters since October 10, 1963. Because of the investigations conducted by the late FBI director, J. Edgar Hoover, of subversive organizations like both the Nation of Islam and the Communist Party, Hoover has been repeatedly slandered by them. Some of the media have only been too happy to repeat these things, probably with the hope of generating a little attention to themselves as well as the accompanying money. The Federal Bureau of Investigation has always been targeted by the people in the past who have felt the FBI is out to get them. In some cases where the people are criminals, they may be right. For instance, Louis Farrakhan, who has threatened to lop off the heads of any undercover FBI agents in his organization in his speech called Warning to the Government. It is probably not rated too highly among FBI members. There have been numerous attempts recently to defame the late J. Edgar Hoover, much of which borders on sheer insanity, the rest of which is an outright licentious rumor by leftist hate mongers. Why would they do that? It is quite simple. By attacking Hoover with their unproven, insipid jeremiads in an attempt to discredit him, they hope that all of his findings will be discredited as well. For instance, there have been rumors that Hoover was a clandestine racist. Nothing could be further from the truth. At the same time, he had left-wing extremists investigated. He was doing the same with the right-wing extremists as well. And despite differences he had with Martin Luther King Jr., Hoover was personally responsible for launching a massive investigation to find King's killer, James Ray, which led to Ray's conviction. Hoover was actually quite impartial and merely went about doing his job. By attacking Hoover, these leftists hoped to destroy the FBI's reputation and credibility. They hope to discredit the facts uncovered by the American government about the leftist hate mongers' nefarious activities. The leftists, in numerous cases, have already destroyed the reputation of some law enforcement agencies. Now they are attempting to destroy anyone in the government who does not hold their pixelated opinions of truth. Hoover has been unfairly maligned and viciously attacked by unsubstantiated allegations, the foremost of which is that he was a homosexual. It also seems ironic that the leftist hate mongers have accused Hoover of being a homosexual, since many of them engage in it or at least promote its acceptance. Some people in the media are only too happy to repeat the baseless rumors concerning Hoover. Anthony Summers wrote a book about J. Edgar Hoover called Official and Confidential: The Secret Life of J. Edgar Hoover. In his book, he alleges that Hoover was a closet homosexual. To prove his ludicrous allegation, he quotes some real honest, and that term is used sarcastically, people. He cites people like Seymour Pollock, a friend of the mobster Meyer Lansky. Damn, why does that name just keep coming up all the time? Pollock said the homosexual thing was Hoover's Achilles heel. Evidently, we are supposed to believe Pollock, a person whose company was the mob, over Hoover, who spent his entire life on maintaining law and order, according to Summers. Kurt Gentry, in his book, J. Edgar Hoover, The Man and the Secrets, reiterates the same baseless rumors as Summers. Contradictory to Gentry's suggestion that Hoover may have been a homosexual, Gentry admittedly noted that Hoover had once warned former President Richard Nixon that ring of homosexualists surrounded him. Apparently, Gentry cannot even see the contradiction in his own writing. If Hoover was indeed a homosexual, he certainly would not care if homosexuals were in Nixon's government. It's time to put an end to the allegation that Hoover was a homosexual. Hoover never did approve of homosexuality, and he made that known. He did not even allow homosexuals to be members of the FBI, which was stated in the FBI's rule book at the time. Ralph de Toledano, in his book J. Edgar Hoover, The Man in His Time, describes how the baseless rumors of Hoover being a homosexual began. It all started in 1964. One of Lyndon Johnson's aides and associates was arrested for committing a homosexual act in a bathroom at a YMCA. Johnson's aide was emotionally collapsed after being arrested for the homosexual act and went to the hospital in Washington, D.C. The White House kept a lid on the story for 24 hours and did not tell the newspapers. One of Hoover's FBI assistants found out that Johnson's aide was in the hospital but did not know the reason why. The FBI assistant sent some flowers to Johnson's aide using J. Edgar Hoover's name, which was customary. The media, hoping to generate a few headlines, were only too happy to make that known. Hoover had difficulty explaining what happened for a couple of reasons, which is described by Toledano. Quote, if Hoover had said he knew something of the homosexual charge, he would have admitted that the FBI was not omniscient. If, on the other hand, he claimed knowledge, then he would be convicting himself of friendship with the homosexual. Close quote. The Communist Party's members heard about the incident with the flowers and decided it would be in their best interest to use some underhanded tactics of their own. They decided to engage in what Hoover described as a smear campaign against him. Their hatred for Hoover has always been well known, so that should not be too surprising. After all, almost single-handedly, Hoover had kept the Communist Party from attaining social acceptance by releasing information about its nefarious activities. The Communist Party sent a letter to several government officials, which was supposed to have been written by Hoover, that suggested Hoover himself was engaging in homosexual affairs. As if Hoover, a man who had fought valiantly against the acceptance of homosexuality into the FBI, would engage in such a perverse act. The letter was described as scurrilous and putrid by Senator Bork Hickenlooper. Hoover proved that the letter was just another disinformation attempt that was made to discredit the FBI by attacking him personally. Though there have been many attempts to use disinformation against Hoover, what he purportedly discovered about King during the course of the bugging is simply incredible. Carl Rowan, an African-American syndicated columnist, was initially perturbed when he discovered that King had been bugged. In one of his columns, Rowan blamed J. Edgar Hoover, director of the FBI, for King being bugged. However, Rowan later discovered that U.S. Attorney General Bobby Kennedy had ordered the bugging. Clyde Tolson, the FBI's associate director, revealed that in response to one of Rowan's columns, quote, the wiretap on Martin Luther King Jr. was specifically approved in advance, in writing, by the late Attorney General of the United States, Mr. Robert F. Kennedy. This device was strictly in the field of internal security and therefore was within the provisions laid down by the then President of the United States, end quote. J. Edgar Hoover reportedly discovered that King had numerous love affairs. Hoover had at least 15 reels of tape about sexual entertainment and conversations between King and Abernathy that might lead to the conclusion that there was a homosexual relationship between the two ministers, noted Rowan. During a discussion with someone in the FBI, Rowan discovered there had been sexual intercourse in the King suite with Reverend Ralph David Abernathy. At that time, there was an orgy. Those conversations both have been taped by one of the FBI's bugs. The black newsletter writer and television talk show host Tony Brown mentioned the reported conversation between King and Abernathy behind closed doors. In Brown's column, he described King's reported love as, quote, "Come on over here, you big black M blank, and let me S blank your D blank." Martin Luther King said to his friend, Reverend Ralph David Abernathy. Ah, cunning copier. In other areas, King's ethics were also questionable, especially for a minister of goodwill. In the course of King's endeavors, he often plagiarized work from others, claiming it as his own and rarely giving credit where it was due. For a person who seemed accustomed to trickery, this was nothing new to him. King would quote others' works verbatim and not give credit to the original authors. In the course of King's plagiarism, he would occasionally change a few words and would often misspell them. The following is an example or sample of King's literary theft. And it basically, it has a list of stuff on one column and then on the right another, so it's an A-B comparison. And I'm not going to go through every one of them, but I'll read a couple of them. And you can pretty much presume that this was pretty much standard, as it lists 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and then there is other plagiarism that will be discussed later on. Let's see here. The original, all feasts are divided into two classes, Feast of Precept and Feast of Devotion. The former are holy days on which the faithful in most Catholic countries refrain from unnecessary servile labor and attend Mass. These include all the Sundays in the year, Christmas Day, their circumcision. Okay, now his quote was this, is a copy. Sounds almost the same. All feasts are divided into two classes, Feast of Precept and Feast of Devotion. The Feast of Precept are holidays, misspelling, on which the faithful in most Catholic countries refrain from unnecessary servile labor and attend Mass. These include all the Sundays in the year, Christmas Day, the circumcision. Word for word. Before we come to consider some well-modern theories, it may well be to refer to view two views, which are now obsolete or obsolescent. Okay, his wording. Before we came to consider some modern theories, it may be well to refer briefly to two views, which are now obsolete or at least obsolescent. And this is, the list just goes on and on. King plagiarized a significant portion of his doctoral dissertation, and this is what I was referring to. When Boston University formed a committee to determine the amount of plagiarism in King's dissertation, the committee concluded that 45% of the first part and 21% of the second part were copied from other people's works. Despite that outrage, and probably due for the most part to King's popularity among African Americans, Boston University felt that no thought should be given to the revocation of Dr. King's doctoral degree. How can King be viewed as a leader to today's youth? He only obeyed the laws that he deemed just. He called for black power. He incited riots. King threatened mayors. He wanted preferential treatment for African Americans. He cheated in school and throughout his life. His love extended way beyond his speeches. Some congressmen felt that the type of leadership given by King was not something to be admired. Congressman Wagner felt that King did not deserve the attention he received. In contradiction to the beliefs held by King's misguided followers, Congressman Wagner told the truth about King's actions. Quote, The Washington Star of yesteryear, September 20th, 1965, summarized the feeling of those in the government and out for the latest bit of meddling by Martin Luther King Jr. in an editorial aptly titled, Martin Luther King, Go Home. There is a great deal of concern in every quarter of the nation over the role his professional wowser has recently taken upon himself, that of a Secretary of State without a portfolio, and I might add, without invitation and without qualifications. King is a meddler and unqualified to tell others how to run either government, either their government or their personal affairs. The fact that he is a Negro gives him the right in the eyes of the deluded liberals to meddle in any affair in which any Negro is involved. Yet the records show wherever his presence is felt, there is often bloodshed, strife, and anarchy. His nonviolence has bred violence. His leadership has turned loose the rampaging mob. His peace has fomented hatred at a time when cool heads and reasoning was needed. Now, I'm going to get to a stopping point here so we can pick up on the next show. But I'm in the middle of a certain piece of this discussing his plagiarism of his dissertation. So let's see here how much time we have. Okay, well, it's only about 7 minutes. I'm just going to go ahead and play the last song because it's about that length of time. Actually, it'll run a little over. So, anyway, before I do that, though, I'll close this out with some final thoughts. So, again, what happens if we don't prevail over these tyrants? Anti-gun is anti-white. Anti-Semitism is a disease. You catch it from Jews. Free men aren't equal, and equal men aren't free. Odin now demands that you grow the fuck up. Distinct peoples have a right to remain distinct. Multiracialism is not self-government. Forced association is not freedom. 1488. So until next time, hail Satan. Well, the song doesn't want to go. There we go.
The red on your door, stop today. The red man's dying, but you're back. gold in the country, your face is so red. With all our young money, your poor can be fed. You're all around in your curtain with disaster. I never really care, and it's just what comes after. Your black stuff dying, but your back is still turned. And your freaks are crying, but your back is still a curtain. You better stop your hiding, or your country will burn. Now you don't wanna see it burn. Oh, the time has come for you, my friend. Oh, all of this ugliness, we must put an end. Before we leave, we must make a stand. Now, people, don't you know that we must make a stand?
Satan,
Satan,
Satan.